The Guardian.
The Darwin Centre is the most significant development in the museum since the original Waterhouse building opened in 1881.
We hope that the young person who visits in September 2009 will be so inspired that they themselves will become the next Darwin.
And what better way to celebrate the stunning architecture and the extraordinary construction feat than by showing you the building empty before we have installed all of the components that make this the museum's most important scientific building and probably the most engaging destination yet for our visitors.
Well, I'm inside what's called Phase 2 of the Darwin Centre at the Natural History Museum. They've basically been showing off their brand new building, which is hidden round the corner of the Natural History Museum. Well, in front of me as I look up is what will no doubt become known as the main feature here, the cocoon, a huge creamy white smooth surface shape with lines zigzagging across it. So let's go and have a look around and find out why this building is so special.
I'd like to hand over now to Anna Maria Indrio, the architect.
It was a competition, international competition we won in 2001, and the brief of this competition was quite complex because it was a question of showing this very huge collection, which was made of very small items, to a public, which should be the worker, should see the work of the scientists behind the scene. So it was very challenging how to do that. So the idea of the cocoon comes out of a need of showing this very huge collection in one, like in one gestus. So the big size of this make an illusion for people of how important this treasure and this collection is for England and for all the world. It protects the collection because the temperature in the cocoon is very stable. It's at 17 degrees, so the collection is all the time in a very stable environment. And then the public penetrate the cocoon on the top and comes down in a tour, which is made by a series of ramps. And getting down, you will have the comprehension of the scientist's work and the collection.
And I will say that it's very impressive that anyone can draw it, but that they can build it is even more impressive.
Mike Donegan, Construction Director, HBG UK. Whatever they say, the original building was fairly bland and dated, and it is a very striking feature. I'm sure at night it will emerge as something quite special when different lighting effects are played upon it. The sprayed concrete is not only an outer shell, but is also the support to the structure. So the structure is an economic structure. There are no joints in the sprayed concrete to prevent, amongst other things, to give it an easy cleaning surface for the collections and to prevent places for infestation by other insects which come in, apparently. It is an external wall, so it is insulated, and the polished plaster itself is merely the outer covering. But of course, it is also extremely inspiring as part of the design. It's a very aesthetically pleasing, very photogenic building. But it is designed principally for the collections, and it will provide an environment that will preserve them in a far better state than their original building. The column erection went very fast. They came in 3x3 on the lorries and were erected by crane. We had two tower cranes here. Pillow roof, inflated roof, very economical in design, it provides insulation, a little bit of a drum when it rains, but very efficient. There were initially some problems with the original company and also with the material, because the material was in high demand in China for the Olympics, and it is a bespoke building. There are many firsts on here.
Well, we're standing in one of the labs just adjacent to the cocoon. I'm with Dr. Michael Dixon, the head of the Natural History Museum. We'll just describe what we can see in front of us.
Well, we're standing now in a science lab space, but we're looking through two panes of glass at the wonderful atrium space with the 8-story-high, 65-meter-long cocoon. What is of interest here is you can see two of the windows from the cocoon from which our visitors will be able to see from the public exhibition space actually into science labs and see what's going on within those spaces. Something that we're very keen to do is to metaphorically throw open the doors so that people can see what historically has been going on behind the scenes at the Natural History Museum.
And we're standing in what looks like one of my old science labs. Is this for children or scientists, proper grown-up ones?
No, this is for proper grown-up scientists. We will have 200 of our research scientists based in this building and predominantly entomologists and botanists, but we will be equipping some of these labs with state-of-the-art equipment for both molecular biology and for imaging. We have some fantastic 3D imaging technology nowadays. Not only do we want the best facilities to use those pieces of equipment, but we actually want the public to be able to engage with what we're doing and see into the spaces. And part of the interpretation on the public exhibition will be how we use those technologies to unlock more secrets about the natural world.
One of the key things is the public involvement. How important is it to get the message across and get people involved?
It's very important. We regard it as a publicly funded institution as our role to contribute to increasing levels of scientific literacy. We have a very strong secondary science program here where demonstrably we're affecting young people's career choice. You will be aware, of course, that there is a shortage of scientists being trained in this country and the potential problems that that will create for our economy if it's not addressed. And we see it as a fundamental part of our role to inspire young people to consider science as a career, to see scientists in this institution, see them as role models, see them as not the kind of stereotypes that sometimes scientists are portrayed as in the media. This has been a hugely ambitious project for the museum. The cost of delivering this project, £78 million. The first phase of Darwin Centre, over 30. So over the last 10 years, we will have spent well over £100 million on Darwin Centre, our major life science complex.
With a building like this, there's, I suppose, some element of pressure in order to get the public through your doors. Are you worried at all about that?
Well, we're finding in recent years, since we went free again in December 2001, that our numbers are still rising. Last year we had 3.8 million visits to the museum, so more than doubled, about 2.5 times what we had previously. We fully anticipate that when the Darwin Centre opens to the public that we'll go through 4 million visits for the first time. Partly, I think, that's driven by public interest in environmental issues. I hope and trust as well that Darwin Centre will prove to be so attractive, both as a building and an architectural spectacle, but also the ways that we present what the museum does, that we'll see ever-increasing numbers of people visiting the museum.
We're in the lower ground plant room, where we house the central air handling systems and energy transfer systems that serve the Darwin Centre Phase 2 building. Peter Nissen, Director, Fulcrum Consulting. The collections have been designed such that they maintain a steady environment of 17 degrees C and 45% RH. And we do a lot of that work down here in the plant room. As we take fresh air from outside, we condition that to the optimum temperature and we deliver it directly into those spaces. We use the central cooling and heating energy direct from the district systems at the museum, because the museum has a combined heat and power with cooling facility as well, known as tri-generation. What we've ended up with here is a very low carbon environmental control system. The air handling units that we stand in and around now all contain an awful lot of energy recovery systems. As the fresh air comes in, also we exhaust stale air out, but we reclaim all the heating, cooling and humidity up to about 75 to 80% of that, again reducing the basic need for energy. So that not only have we created these conditions up in the collections, they don't use a great deal of energy, and the energy that they do use has come from low carbon production methods. So we're really pleased.
This is
is where the public will enter into the cocoon. It's obviously quite an interestingly shaped space here, and it will introduce some of the things that people will be able to see. And also, this is where we will be introduced to the interactive scientists who will be part of the tour as you go around. It's actually a self-guided tour. You'll follow along down the ramps through the inside of the cocoon.
My name's Sharon Ament, and I'm the Director of Public Engagement. That's all the activities that face the public. This will really do something that we have not been able to do so far, which is bring people, general public, eyeball to eyeball with a scientist and give them the opportunity to interrogate and talk and discuss and interact with people who do his science day in, day out. So it's a really great opportunity.
And here at the first window, you'll be able to see into our historic collections. And this is actually where the collections will be kept and scientists will be able to use them. But you'll also be able to see in, and this is where you'll see some of Hans Sloane's first specimens and some beautifully bound rare books and original drawings of specimens.
Scientists are some of the most stimulating people I've ever met, and they will enjoy it. I've seen them talking to school kids, talking to OAPs. You know, really, they really get a lot from engaging with the public. I think we will learn a lot when this engagement happens. And will it work? I'm sure we're going to make some mistakes over the time. This is the day one on opening. It's got another 100 or so years to live. So, you know, over that period, we're going to be changing what we do here.
Looks like we're approaching the cockpit end of this strange shape.
And also through some of these windows, which you can't see through at the moment, will be actually scientists working preparation spaces. So you might be able to see scientists pressing and preparing herbarium sheets, which are the pressed plants. Or you might, for example, see a scientist who's just come back from Costa Rica with 5,000 new insects, and he or she will be sorting them out. So that's the kind of thing you'll be able to see through those windows.
The important thing about the science that we're doing here, which is taxonomy and systematics, is about naming things and looking at the relationship of species in the natural world, is actually that's a really accessible science for people to get involved in. It's not kind of physics. We're all scientists in that regard. We all organise and name things. And so for us, this is a really good way to enable people to kind of see the scientists in themselves.
Comes acoustically quite interesting here. This is where, through the curved glass, you can see into the laboratory spaces. So, for example, there's some DNA labs here, and this is where they'll be doing work to, for example, looking at the DNA of mosquitoes to help kind of eradicate malaria eventually, and that kind of thing will be going on. And in the imaging labs, for example, you might be invited to go online later that evening and you'll be able to see what the scientists have been looking at or working on. So that kind of thing to try and... So you don't just see into the science spaces, but you really find out more about what they're actually doing at them.
So I'm standing inside the cocoon at the moment with Professor Richard Lane, the Director of Science at the Natural History Museum. A very impressive structure.
Yeah, it's absolutely remarkable. We're in what will be a completely controlled environment for keeping our collection. In this building, we will have some 17 million insects and 3 million plants. They'll be at about 17 degrees centigrade and 45 degrees relative humidity. So that really preserves them in the long term. Some of these parts of the collection are really... Really old, dating back to 250 years. Some of the earliest specimens from European explorers are actually here now, either whether they're Captain Cook's voyages or Sir Hans Sloane in the West Indies. The area we're standing at the moment will be completely full of collections on these racks that are rolling backwards and forwards. In fact, as we were saying earlier, they're so good that we can't even actually make them make a noise, which is rather a shame. The central part of the building is for storing the collection. Then connected to the outside of it are where the labs are and the various write-up spaces. The public will be able to walk through the middle of this huge cocoon structure and learn about how science is done. So this isn't just about telling them about the natural world, which is what you might find in the rest of the museum. This is focusing almost entirely on how we do science, why we do it, what it feels like to be a scientist, and finally what people can do to become engaged do something next? You know, what can they do? And then finally, at the base of this building is a brand new centre for amateur scientists and amateur naturalists. Those people that the museum's always had good connections with in the past, who generated a lot of the knowledge that we use, especially about the UK biodiversity. And that'll be a place where people will be able to come in, use latest sources of information, look at used specimens for reference purposes, and talk to scientists who actually work in the building. We'll be able to tell people more or less what's happening on a daily basis. So when they're looking into labs, very short description of this is roughly what this project's about, and even down to these are the scientists visiting us. I mean, the whole museum complex has between 5,000 and 8,000 scientists a year visiting us, spending over 20,000 research days in the building. We'll be able to say where people are from and what they're doing. And I think that's terrific, because that gives you a great sense of the fact that science is an international business, and people are travelling to other parts of the world to do their research, and other people from those developing countries maybe, or other big science nations coming into London or this place to do their science. I think also it'll show a little glimpse of the, how can we put it in the nicest possible way, the huge variety that scientists come in, all shapes and forms and exotic and otherwise hairdos. And I think that's really important, because it shows that science is not something completely separate, just old men with white coats and white beards, but actually growing, if not entirely diverse group of people, certainly growing in that way. And that should be quite engaging for young people to see what science is actually like, which is not quite the opportunity they have in the school classroom.
An unusual concept to, I suppose, study the scientists almost, like in a specimen jar. Will they enjoy that?
Yeah, interesting. They're not quite in a specimen jar. The nature of the building is actually quite clever, where if you're a member of the scientific staff, because there's so much glass in this building, you'll be able to see the public. Kind of remind you you're in a natural history museum. It's the conjunction of science and communication. None of the scientists will have their permanent workstation, such as anyone ever has a permanent workstation, completely on view. So there'll be laboratories where people go to work, and then they obviously have other spaces to go to. So you'll see the dynamism of science rather than just observing people under a microscope. So I hope it won't feel like they're in a goldfish bowl, specimen jar. It shouldn't feel like that. Most of the way in which the building's designed is to give these slightly tangential views, so it's not confrontational.
In the process of getting this building, you've had to create another building. Tell us about that operation. I mean, huge logistical problems, and you know, how do you catalogue such a huge collection?
Yeah. Well, the old building, the old entomology building, was started construction in the 1930s and got interrupted by the Second World War, and then finished in the 1940s. It was a story of two halves, and was great for its time. You know, it was a nice building for 1930s science, but of course that's hardly 21st century. And so we had to demolish that. Of course, clearly before we demolished it, we had to move all the specimens out. So they moved 135,000 drawers, that's nearly 25 million insects, moved out without any permanent damage to any of them, which is just remarkable. And we moved it to other parts of the museum. So one of our public galleries we had to take off from public exhibition and fill that with entomologists and specimens. And then other material was moved down to Wandsworth, where we had a large store. So, of course, you don't just move collections, you move people as well. An enormous enterprise. A lot of poor people thought at the time that we couldn't do it and this would be the end of the world, etc. One of the great interesting things about that kind of observation is it was entirely data-free. It was just people's speculation, not exactly scientific. But now we've actually done it, we can demonstrate that we can actually move quite major collections, not without some disruption. Obviously, labs can't just turn them on and off. When we're moving the botanical collections in, we'll be reorganising all the botanical collections, which is exactly the same time as Kew and the Royal Botanic Gardens Edinburgh are also reorganising their collections. So we'll all be able to use the same system, so that much easier to move seamlessly between those three great herbaria in the UK. And so it's, you can only do that if you have a spectacular event like a big move.
So that concludes our tour of phase two of the Darwin Centre at the Natural History Museum in London. I've now stepped outside the glass building enveloping that huge cocoon into, well, a building site, debris all around me here, because it's still being constructed. It won't open to the public until September 2009.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.